First of all, the D2L quizzes have been set up now, which they haven't for a while, for chapters 19, 20, and 21. Chapters 19 and 20 are due at 2 a.m. tomorrow morning, and then chapter 21 is due on Thursday morning at 2 a.m. Hopefully things are set up now that the key will be returned to you by 10 p.m. this evening for chapters 19 and 20, and the key for 21 will be returned to you by 10 p.m. Wednesday evening. That's assuming you've completed two attempts. Otherwise, if you just do the one attempt, it's set up to return it to you at the due date. Lab reports. I did get all caught up on lab reports this weekend, so you should have gotten those back. If you did not get them back, see me. That means that I did not receive one from you, or perhaps have it misplaced in my files. The D2L grades, our summer secretary is entering those as we speak this morning, so I should know then by lab time if she got those in, and you should be able to see them on D2L hopefully sometime today. So if those grades do not match, do let me know so we can get that taken care of. At this stage, I think we're ready to go ahead and look at some applications of electrochemistry. We'll start first of all with Weavy here on batteries.
So when it comes to batteries, we can generally put them into two categories, non-rechargeable and rechargeable. Start off, what is a battery? It's a combination of one or more voltaic cells used to produce electrical energy from chemical processes. And just a really quick review from last Thursday, a voltaic cell contains at least two half cells. One is an oxidation reaction and the other one is a reduction. And in order for us to get the energy that we need, there has to be a spontaneous reaction between the two half cells. This is a diagram of a voltaic cell. Starting with non-rechargeable batteries, it's most commonly known as a primary cell, and it's defined by its non-reversible chemical reaction. And it's non-reversible because during the reaction between the half cells, the primary cell uses up one or both of its electrodes.
By the way,
Well, oxidation occurs at the anode, and reduction will occur at the cathode. In a primary cell, the identities of the anode and cathode are going to be fixed, so the anode of a primary cell will have a permanent negative charge. And you can commonly find primary cells in alkaline batteries. Alkaline batteries are a type of disposable cells. And it's a reaction between zinc and manganese oxide. And the reason why it's called an alkaline battery is because it gets its name from the electrolyte of a potassium hydroxide. And the anode is made out of zinc powder, and the cathode is made from manganese oxide. So in the standard batteries that we use in our electronics, like our calculators or remote controls, the anode is the flat end of the battery, and then the end with the raised button is the cathode. And these are the half reactions that occur. The top one is the oxidation, and the bottom one is the half reaction. So the lifespan of a primary cell, even if you don't take it out of its packaging, it could lose up to 8 to 20% of its original charge within a year, and this is called the self-discharge rate. You can also lower it the self-discharge rate is at a room temperature. But you can lower it if you put it at a lower temperature, but if the temperature is too low, it can be damaged if it's frozen. And then if you tried to recharge a disposable battery, it wouldn't be a very good idea because it could lead to an explosion because the disposable batteries aren't really meant to be reversed because they can't be. And this is what a battery explosion of a primary cell looks like. It just kind of bursts and ends up like that. And moving on to rechargeable batteries, these are called secondary cells, and they are defined by their readily reversible chemical reaction. Unlike the primary cells, the electrodes are not fixed. So it's reversible because when an electric current is applied to it, so when you put it in the charger, the current is sent in the opposite direction, so it causes a reduction reaction to be at the negative electrode and an oxidation reaction to take place at the positive electrode. So pretty much the anode becomes positive and then the cathode becomes negative. And this is a diagram of a battery being charged. And then even though it's reversible, there's other things that need to be true for the battery to actually be rechargeable. The chemical reaction needs to be efficiently reversed, because if it's not, you won't have as many recharging cycles. And then also the chemical reaction must return the electrode materials to the original physical state. I read that in an example, if you charge it a lot and it doesn't return to its physical state, then rough filaments can form, and then it will cause the electrodes to grow. And then if the electrodes have contact, then it can cause a short circuit in the battery. And then if you're charging a rechargeable battery, you shouldn't keep it on the charger after it's done, because if it's being charged excessively or overcharged, then there's a mixture of oxygen and hydrogen gas that can be produced a lot faster than it can actually leave the walls of the battery, so then that can also cause an explosion. This is kind of an extreme case of a battery explosion on the computer. And then the lifespan of a rechargeable battery, the self-discharge rate is a lot faster than a disposable, but you can also refresh it by charging it. It has very poor shelf life. And then when it reaches the end, instead of just stop working, it's going to just gradually decrease in its capacity to give out electricity. And then this is for both disposable and rechargeable batteries. To make them last longer, you should store them at lower temperatures, because then it will slow down the chemical reactions. And this could increase the life by 5% of a disposable battery, and it could increase the life of a rechargeable by a few months. So if you want to have maximum voltage, you should really use them at room temperature. Pretty much freezing temperature. I can't remember the exact 0 degrees.
Yeah, just like we learned about freezing point compression, you have the solids in there, so I mean, it's always freezing point within the cell, but there would be some minimum temperature that would depend on whatever that concentration of the.
I read a lot, just not put it in your freezer to store it.
Okay, very good. Thanks. And I was just going to add one thing here, too. There are some, you can actually leave the batteries on some chargers, but you have to have an integrated circuitry in order to do so. And we experienced some problems with some of our rechargeable batteries at home. And my wife's got this apparatus for the fuse or whatever, where the batteries last and found like about 3 or 4 recharging cycles. And if you look at the package, it will say, do not overcharge. But there are some with integrated circuitry that do detect once you achieve the old voltage and they will actually cut out. They don't always work. So you really should know after this whether or not they can be overcharged or not, because it is very difficult. All right, next up. Okay, Heather. Put your windows on, stock additional elements, and well, you don't have to. You can stand wherever you want.
It's easiest to describe this.
If I tell you, like, what the real-world use of sacrificial anodes and cathode protection is, you'll find this in the glass lining of water heaters, which use magnesium or aluminum anodes, and then offshore oil rigs
these special anodes that are made to be in salt water. The sacrificial anode is a metallic anode that's used in cathodic protection, and it's the metal that protects the cathode, and so it's dissolved before the cathode is dissolved, and it needs to be replaced, which is why it's called sacrificial. It's dissolved to protect the metallic components, and aluminum or magnesium are the most common anodes that are used. And these metals form their own oxide coatings, which also prevent their own corrosion. So they're supposed to corrode, but it slows down their corrosion. And the sacrificial anode is a piece of corrodible metal that's attached from a conductive solid to a less corrodible metal, which are both submerged in a conductive liquid. So I guess think about it as, they talked about it in the book as like underground piping, and the liquid would be like the moist soil that surrounds it, and so that the iron piping underground would have to be covered by aluminum or magnesium metals. For this kind of corrosion protection to function, there must be an electron pathway between the anode and the metal that's being protected, so like a wire or a direct contact. An ion pathway between the anode and the metal that is being protected, so water or damp soil. And with all these components, it'll form a closed circuit for everything to work. Iron does not rust in air, so you can't put this together like in here and have it work. You need those two components. And iron does not rust in air-free water. Oxygen must be present for it to rust. It rusts at a low pH, and this would be like the cathode. And iron rusts faster with a less active metal, such as copper, and is slower with a more active metal, such as zinc. And the cathode, cathodic protection, is a technique that's used to control corrosion of a metal surface by making it work as a cathode of electrochemical cell. And the cathode, in relation to the sacrificial anode, is the metal that's being protected. And again, real-world uses would be to protect steel, water, or fuel pipelines, storage tanks, ships or offshore oil rigs, and others that were previously talked about. And cathodic protection was first used in 1824 in the Navy, it was discovered. And in this time, it was discovered that iron corrodes much faster than copper, so that they figured that copper could protect. And eventually, the sacrificial anode must be replaced after it corrodes. It rusts away, and the anode material has been consumed. Otherwise, the iron will start to rust. Well, you need an electron pathway, which would be a wire or a direct contact. I think.
There is actually a small amount of current that would have occurred when things rust. Because what happens is oxygen, like on your car, you have a drop of water, and then the car, a piece of iron. What will happen is that the oxygen will come in and act as the oxidizing agent, and the oxygen winds up getting reduced. In the meantime, the iron that's in the car gets oxidized by oxygen. But as Heather suggested, it only occurs whenever there's water present. And what the whole process of rusting is an electrochemical process where it goes actually, it's like a small battery. You have a drop of water on our iron, but it's a small current that is driven by the oxygen being taken in, and the iron then being oxidized to iron. Leave iron free iron, the process.
In the book, too, it said that cars are painted so that they'll rust slower. Mm-hmm. So that's supposed to be the paint first.
Another application that was mentioned, but not in the sense here, and that is only over the galvanized metals.
Galvanic anode is also sacrificial anode. I had that written down.
Yeah, and so basically what a galvanized nail is a piece of iron coated with.
Okay.
I know what it was coated with.
Mm-hmm.
Zinc.
Oh.
Yeah, they dip it in zinc. And so they either plate it, or they can actually dip it in some molten zinc. And that's why it's super difficult to plate it. But the whole idea then is that the zinc is almost sacrificed in preference to the iron.
It's in your book too, if I didn't explain. It's kind of confusing. There's stuff in your book about it too, and pictures, which are helpful.
Very good. Thank you. And then we have Esther here talking about electroplating.
All right. Electroplating is basically used to take a metal that has a desired quality to put it into something else, and you do that with using electrical current. And the process they use is called electrical deposition to do this. And I'm going to draw here to show you. So this is a beaker or something. And then you have your desired metal, which would be like your silver right here. And this is your anode from this side. And then you have, it is attached to a battery. And then on this side, it would be your cathode, which would be like a spoon or something. And then they're put into, this solution is called your electrolyte. And, and this one is like HNO3. That's your electrolyte. And then basically the current flows into the cathode and causes the current flows into the cathode and it causes the metal ions that are in the solution be released, and then as it's flowing, the Ag plus from the anode goes into the solution and replaces the solution as the spoon is being coated with the Ag plus. And basically, the anode is oxidized because it's losing electrons, and then the cathode is then gaining electrons. And then the number of electrons that's being reduced, oxidized, is the same as being produced. And this is used with basically coatings or gold or something like that. Yeah.
If I can interrupt there, when you say that the silver ions go on there, what actually happens to the silver ions?
In the spoon?
Yeah. So like, what happens to the silver ions in the solution when they go to that spoon there?
They are attacked.
Okay. And what, I guess what I'm trying to say is, what charge do they wind up with when they're attached to the
spoon? I'm sorry, I had to put it down. These make cations, and then these make anions. And they make a negative charge. So the side that is reduced makes anions, and the side that is oxidized makes cations, and that this is positive.
So if the silver ion picks up an electron, what does it become?
This side?
No, on the other side.
On this side?
If the silver ion picks up an electron, what does it become?
What does it become?
Yes. If you have a silver ion positive charge that picks up an electron, what does it form? On this one. Solid. Because Ag plus one electron would yield.
Solid.
Exactly.
Sorry, I didn't answer the question. Alright. So cathodes always become cathodes.
Any questions for Esther?
Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when the battery goes through in the current, this AgNO3, it dissolves and it becomes Ag plus to NO3 minus. And then this Ag plus goes in here. And then while it's going through the Ag plus from here, replenishes the solution.
But the important part of it all is that that silver ion will pick up electron and yield. The silver ion will pick up the electron and yield solid, exactly.
And it gets attached
to
this,
which is
yeah.
All right, very good, thank you. All right, I have a couple more applications here of electrochemistry. One of them is one that you're going to see tomorrow. I believe it's tomorrow. And let's go ahead here. This is over. We don't have a fuel cell presentation, but I can give a little information on fuel cells, and then the one that you're going to see in lab, is it tomorrow or is it Wednesday, on electrolysis? Who's got the electrolysis one? That's Andrea, and when are you doing yours? Is it Wednesday? Okay, so they have one. If you want to stick around and see one on electrolysis, I can give you just a brief overview of electrolysis. And electrolysis is a method by which you are running electrical current through a conducting medium, and the whole idea is to have oxidation occur at the anode side and reduction occur at the other, produce some sort of desired product or material. Now, the one that they're working with is one in which they're producing some hydrogen and oxygen gas. And so, if I would have to think about this here, produce the hydrogen and oxygen, have you figured out yet which side is the oxidation, which one is the reduction? H plus is going to form H2, so that's going to go from plus 1 down to 0. So let's see, that would be reduction. So reduction is going to occur at the cathode. So they're going to wind up producing hydrogen gas at the cathode and some oxygen gas from at the anode. And then they're going to collect some of the gases and test them. But some of the other things that are used, these are some diagrams that are shown in your text. Be the electrolysis of molten salts. And so there's one figure here that appears on page 834, in which they're showing the production of some sodium metal and some chlorine gas from a liquid or molten sodium chloride. Now, by molten, we're talking about something occurring at a very hot temperature, and typically the way that many of these things are done industrially is in this molten or liquid state. And it turns out that one of the first ways that sodium metal was produced was actually by the electrolysis of moist sodium chloride. And by moist, it just means it takes some salt like this here, and add a teeny amount of water to it, and then you can run electric current through it, you can then derive or obtain some sodium metal. The problem with that is it's very dangerous. Now, I've not demonstrated it for you this second semester, but one of my favorite first semester demos is the reaction of sodium, lithium, and potassium with water. How many have seen that reaction before? Okay. That's one that I know that myself and all my colleagues demonstrate in one here, but what happens if you react sodium with water? That lights on fire, or maybe it explodes because of the emission of hydrogen gas. So the obtaining the sodium in a moist environment is not the smartest way to do it, but it is the way that sodium metal was first obtained. So today the way that that's done is that we would wind up placing them in something that's very hot and dipping in the molten state, and then obtain the sodium and chlorine in that method.
one of the applications that I have here as well is one that I experienced myself on a tour. In fact, I might be going there again next week. I visited back in 1999, I believe it was, or 98, the Morenci mine out in east central Arizona. And what's cool about the Morenci, it's the copper mine, is that it is an open pit mine. And how many have ever seen an open pit mine before? They're massive, they're huge. And this open pit mine, now the pictures here, kind of hard to put this all in perspective, but it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about a mile across. And I don't know if you can see this thing right here, but these are dump trucks, and these aren't any ordinary dump trucks. The tires on these dump trucks was probably about 10 feet tall, and so these dump trucks themselves were probably about 20 feet tall, sitting between 15 and 20 feet tall, sitting out here on the other side. So it kind of puts in perspective as to how large this open pit mine must be.
Sure.
So again, you're looking at these dump trucks sitting out here. And now what's done in this particular mine, and let's see, I did not go through my pictures this morning to remember what all was on here, but basically what's done is down here is a pond. And on the side here, what those dump trucks do is they dump down along the side some copper ore. And I do have some of this copper ore that I saved from that trip. Something like this. It passes around and I'll look at them. But it's basically some copper minerals that are contained within limestone. And so what's done then is that they take the limestone, they crush it up, they have some big crushers, and then they load up these dump trucks, and then they pour it down the sides of this open pit. And then what's done in there is, I'll go back here, what's done in there is that there's some pipes that come out of the sides along this pit, and they pump sulfuric acid out along the walls of those pits. And so the sulfuric acid comes down, the sulfuric acid dissolves the limestone that's in there, and it runs down the side, and that sulfuric acid plucks down the bottom. In the meantime, what the sulfuric acid does is it dissolves and removes the copper from solution, forming copper T-sulfate. And so this is basically an extremely acidic pond down here of sulfuric acid with the copper ions in solution. And then what they do is they take that liquid that's down at the bottom, and then they pump it up into these huge rooms. And then sitting in here, these are plates of copper that measure probably about 3 feet by 3 feet, and they hang down into this bath, this entire room then, where they've pumped all that copper sulfate solution, acidic copper sulfate solution, up inside of here, and then they run the electrical current through here. And a small diagram of this is shown as to how the metal is purified in your text. At least there used to be. There we go. On page 840. And how it actually forms then is that, just as was shown here with Esther's presentation with the anode and the cathode, what happens then is that the zinc ions and copper ions leave the anode, and the copper gets attracted over here and gets reduced to copper metal and forms on the anode. And so then you have these sheets then that are formed, they're pulled out of that particular bath. And then from there, those sheets are collected, stamped, weighed, and then they ship them out. This is another picture that I took from there, in which they were also trying to see if they could obtain gold out of the copper mine. And so the way that that's done is they fire them in the furnace. They basically separate the rock there and the gold, and if there's any gold present, it falls down to the bottom of the ingot here because of its very high density, and then it's collected. But I guess what the whole process reminds me of, if I go back here, is that I was looking at this whole thing as just like, wow, what is this thing doing to the environment? And so what we were told here, is, and again, this is almost 10 years ago that I was out there, is that in order to select a site like this, they have to do studies of all the bedrock and stuff that lies underneath, and they have to do this in a as much as possible an earthquake-free zone. And so they would look at this only being able to be done above rock that is impervious to any chemicals. So the mine here has been going for, I don't know, 40, 50 years, but they say that if you go in and test the groundwater below here, that they have not found any significant leakage or anything of copper ions into the solution. But I still look at this as being a huge vat of sulfuric acid. And those are not boats, but there are some sort of floats out there. I believe they're probably some sort of pump or maybe some skimming device. I don't remember what those are down there. But no, they weren't boats. But it's something associated with removing the copper sulfate out of there. Anyhow, anybody have any questions or comments on this? What's that? Actually, the place where I smelled it the most, I didn't smell it out there, but when I went inside the room here where they had all these copper plates, if you ever smelled, I don't know, like for me, I know that I've puffed around with stuff all the time, and you'll open up a battery if you have like a lead acid battery recharging, and you can kind of smell when it's recharging, it will bubble a small amount, you can smell a little bit of acid fumes. That's exactly what it smelled like through there. And now the people that worked there, if I remember right, they walked around in masks and everything. But I can imagine that one time when this was first formed, that people were walking through there all the time without any protective gear, and could not have been good inhaling those acid fumes all day. Anybody else? Okay, then fuel cells, another very interesting application of electrochemistry. Many think that the direction that we're going with automobiles and energy for the future is with fuel cells. Your text does discuss fuel cells to a small degree in section 8. And I'm seeing a figure on page 832. With this particular figure with a fuel cell, one of the reasons, a fuel cell is very much like a battery. Okay, so I think of fuel cells and batteries as being pretty much the same thing. The only difference is that in the battery, eventually you run out of reactants, and then the battery winds up going dead. With a fuel cell, what happens is that you still generate an electrical current, but you have a continuous supply of fuel coming on into the fuel cell where the oxidation and reduction occurs. And so you don't really run out of reactants in a fuel cell unless you actually run out of the fuel that's being supplied. But one of the reasons why many believe that this is the direction that we're heading is because of the most efficient reaction that we have between a couple reactant oxygen is one between reactant hydrogen and oxygen. And what's nice about this reaction, the only product between a hydrogen and oxygen reaction is water, or H2O. And one of the problems with a hydrogen reaction is that if we were to think about a hydrogen reaction, which I know, again, if you had temp 1 here, it's one we do all the time, if you've seen a hydrogen balloon explode, okay, that's one that you show the tremendous amount of energy being given off by a small mass of hydrogen. And hydrogen, used in that context, is very reactive. There's often a concern about the storage. Today, however, we've looked at a way of making the hydrogen less reactive by the way it's stored. And rather than combusting them to obtain the energy, we still have the same overall reaction occurs between hydrogen and oxygen to form water. But instead of having an explosion produce the energy, we instead generate an electrical current to run the fuel cell. Now, the biggest problem here today is we don't have a large source of hydrogen that's easily or economically obtained. However, if the price of gas stays up really high, it may very well become economical in the fairly near future. By fairly near future, I don't know, maybe 20 years or 50 years. But where do we have a whole bunch of hydrogen locked up? In water. Exactly. So the whole idea is that probably eventually what's going to be done is there's going to be some way by which we're going to electrolyze water, obtain the hydrogen, and then use that. And probably the easiest way to do it is going to be using solar electricity. And so we'd have some solar cells then that would run the decomposition of water to make hydrogen and oxygen, and then we can take the hydrogen fuel and use that in the fuel cell to get the energy back out of it. Of course, the one downside to solar energy, it depends upon us having sun or something to drive it. And of course, the sun isn't always out. And so the idea then is that with the fuel cells, that'd be a way for us to store up the solar energy as we store it up as hydrogen, and then we use the hydrogen in a fuel cell. But again, how far off we're talking, I think really depends on the economics. As long as fuel, even though it seems expensive to you, still as an alternative, fuel is cheap. It's a lot cheaper than it is for hydrogen right now. But as soon as the economics become such that hydrogen is cheaper than petroleum-based products, we're probably going to be stuck in a petroleum-based economy until we see something there with cost that brings the cost of hydrogen production down. It would, because one of the problems with anything with internal combustion engines is you have a lot of moving parts. And so if you get rid of those moving parts, that's probably the number one place where things go wrong. It's either in the engine or the transmission, and those are the expensive things. So I would think that if this were redeveloped, that could ultimately wind up saving some money in terms of automobile costs and moving parts. Okay, anybody else? What's that? If we use water? I think that by using... the other thing you do with this is that right now we're kind of limited to using metals in our automobiles because we have to have the high temperature combustion occurring. We could probably use a lot lighter materials and things that are relatively inert, like plastics and other plastic composites, which then would not be subject to corrosion. So that would be a trade-off that we'd probably be able to make. But yes, if we're dealing with metals, then we would have been subject to corrosion. But metals are heavy, and the heavier things are, of course, that's one of the problems with hybrid cars and electric cars these days, is that we've been trying to fix them to metal. It takes a lot of energy to move dense metals, but if they can move to plastics and composites, in that sense, you're going to wind up with lighter vehicles that can move around with a lot less energy. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, then, a very brief introduction here to where we're going to be wrapping up the course, and that is going to be on nuclear chemistry. And by very brief, I am guessing that probably on your exam tomorrow, we'll probably only be through section one. Now, with the nuclear chemistry, we're going to be using something called a nuclide symbol. And the nuclide symbol is something that you should have seen before in your first semester course. A nuclide symbol would have been something that looks like this. This is an example of a nuclide symbol. Now, let's review here what these things stand for. This number down below here is called, again, atomic number. And what the information can we get from the atomic number?
The number of protons in the nucleus. And so if we deal with a nuclide symbol will tell us then the number of protons in the nucleus. This number up above is called a mass number, and the mass number is the sum of the protons and neutrons. Now, if we were to do a generic nuclide symbol, a generic nuclide symbol would look like this, where the mass number is this thing right here, and then the atomic number, which is the number of protons, is down below. And this is one of those things that I never really thought made sense. I don't know why they use the symbols A and Z the way they do. To me, it would make sense to use A to represent the atomic number and Z for a mass number. But this is the correct labeling. We use A to indicate the mass number, and we use Z to represent the atomic number. And X here is just a generic atomic symbol for the element. Now, one of the ways that we would read this out then is we would say that this is Mercury 2006. And we might sometimes write it simply as HG206, or we might write it as simply HG, the superscript of 206 to the left of the atomic symbol. All of these are the same way as representing the same isotope of mercury, and that is the isotope that has a mass number of 206. Now, just so it's clear what we mean when we talk about a nuclide and how that's different from an isotope, for our purposes in here, we're going to put it, you'll find me use the term isotope and nuclide interchangeably. When we talk about the isotope of an element, an isotope simply refers to a form of the element that has a different number of neutrons. And a nuclide is pretty much the same thing, except nuclide refers specifically to the nucleus. And so when we talk about isotope, we might be talking about the atom as a whole, but the nuclide simply refers to what we find in the nucleus. And so for that reason, when we talk about the nuclide symbol, while it is true that this atomic number is also equal to the number of electrons, we'd be more concerned about that if we're referring to it as the isotope. When we talk about nuclides, again, we're really not so much interested about the electrons. We're interested simply what's in the nucleus. And the only thing we find in the nucleus is protons and neutrons. Now we're going to look at a couple of different types of processes here in terms of nuclear reactions. And the types of nuclear reactions we're going to look at will be radioactive decay, and nuclear bombardment reactions. Now, radioactive decay, this is one that occurs when a nucleus spontaneously disintegrates releasing radiation. And this type of radiation could be alpha, beta, gamma types of rays, so alpha, beta, gamma rays, as an example. And we also find out that we can also produce positrons as well, and we'll mention positrons in a moment here. Now, nuclear bombardment reactions are referred to as process of transmutation. And this occurs when a nucleus
is bombarded. Or struck by another particle or nucleus. Now, the types of particles that we're going to look at will be as follows. First of all, one that you should all be familiar with, and that is a proton. And a proton, if we look at the atomic number of a proton, the atomic number of a proton is equal to 1. And it would have a mass number of 1 as well. And so the way that we often write a proton would be like this.
Where there's one proton, and the sum of the protons and neutrons is 1, and so we would attach that with a symbol of H.
And sometimes we might write that also like this. So we look at nuclear reactions, there's a couple different ways that we write a proton. Another particle that we look at is a neutron. And a neutron would have an atomic number of 0 and a mass number of 1. And so we'd write a symbol then for a neutron like this. Now an alpha particle is one that is essentially the same as a nucleus of helium. It contains 2 protons and 2 neutrons. If it contains 2 protons and 2 neutrons, that means its atomic number would be 2, and its mass number would be 4. And so this would be the symbol for an alpha particle. Sometimes we write an alpha particle like this. And then we have an electron.
And now, if we say that a proton has an atomic number of plus 1, then an electron essentially has an atomic number of negative 1. And of course, because there's no neutrons or no protons, the mass number would be 0.
And this is also called a beta particle, and so we may also write it sometimes like this. That's the Greek letter beta. Now it turns out that all forms of matter have an antimatter counterpart, and the antimatter counterpart of an electron is a particle called a positron. Now a positron has the same mass as an electron, except its charge is opposite. And so we'd say that the positron has an atomic number of plus 1, has a mass number of 0, and then we assign it the symbol here for the electron. And it turns out that there's also a particle here that is opposite in charge to an electron. We'll have that opposite charge to a proton, and we call that particle an antiproton. It's basically a proton that has a negative 1 charge. And some contend that we might even have some antimatter out there in the universe that we're not even accounting for, that has a whole lot of mass we can't even see because of the fact that it is the antimatter. But the positron then, again, has a mass number of 0. We do assign it an atomic number equal to 1. And then we have what we call a gamma photon, which isn't really a particle as such, but it is a form of radiation that's given off. We sometimes label it like this. Now, the reactions that we're going to look at. We're going to look at some nuclear reactions as an example of one. And an example of such a reaction might be one like this, where we take thorium, and let's say we take thorium-232, and we know that thorium-232 is an alpha emitter. So we're given here that thorium here is an alpha emitter, which means that it gives off alpha particles. We can figure out then what happens to the thorium quite simply by looking at the type of product or particle that's produced. And if thorium produces alpha particles, remember now that we've already written a symbol for alpha particles. That is, we'd have atomic number of 2 and a mass number 4. It would then be associated with the element helium. This leads us to be able to predict what this other product in here might be. And so this is very much just like algebra. And that is, if we know that the sum of the atomic numbers must equal the sum on the other side, and the sum of the mass numbers on this side must equal the sum on the other, we should then be able to figure out the atomic number and the mass number of the missing particle here. And so the mass number, let's start again. The atomic number of the missing particle here must be 88, and the missing mass number must be 228. And again, we get that because 8 plus 88 plus 2 will give us 90, and 228 plus 4 is going to give us 232. And so then if we wanted to fill in the atomic symbol, what would the atomic symbol be? It'd be Ra, which of course is radium. And so we simply fill in the atomic symbol like this. And then if we wanted to do one with a beta emitter, let's say we look at an example of a beta emitter. And this is pretty much where we're going to have to wrap up for today. Example of a beta emitter might be something like phosphorus 32. And so if we know that phosphorus 32 is a beta emitter, and we want to know what other particle is produced. A beta particle, of course, again has an atomic number of negative 1, mass number of 0. And so if we wanted to figure out the other product that's formed, the other product here must have an atomic number of 16, because 16 plus a negative 1 is going to give us 15. And the mass number of this product must be 32. And of course, the atomic number 16, we're then looking at the element sulfur. Atomic number of 16, we'll put that on in here. So what we're going to be doing next week then is we're going to be doing some more of the math of this. I'm showing you very quickly here today. I guess what I'm showing you here today is the math. What we're going to do, next week. What we're going to do tomorrow is we're going to figure out how we can tell whether something's an alpha emitter or a beta emitter and so forth. So, at a very minimum tomorrow, you should be able to look at a nuclide symbol and tell how many protons and neutrons there are given the nuclide symbol. And you should be able to complete a very basic nuclear equation, fill in some missing material in there.
And you would give us if it was which type of...
Well, I probably even want to tell you whether it's a beta emitter or an alpha emitter.
I'd probably have something in where I'd give a reactant and product, and you'd have to figure out what the missing one is in there. So that's probably the minimum for tomorrow. Then, for chapters... Hold on, guys. We got about 2 minutes left here, please. Then for the other material, we have chapters 19 and 20 to cover on the exam. Your exam is not written yet, but here's what I would anticipate for tomorrow's exam, as ones that we have similar to ones I have done in the past. I would anticipate probably a little bit more multiple choice than we've had on the previous two exams, mainly because my turnaround deadline and for getting the ACS exam all ready for you is a little bit shorter, so I probably anticipate a little bit more on the multiple choice.
As far as problems go, we've done stuff with delta H, delta S, and delta G. And so you should be able to do calculations with any one of those. We did some calculation of the equilibrium constant K from either delta G or a standard cell potential. You should be able to determine spontaneity of reactions. You should be able to determine whether they are enthalpy-driven or entropy-driven. And then you should, if a reaction is non-spontaneous at room temperature, you should be able to determine the temperature at which reactions do become spontaneous. And of course, whatever else is in there, but those are kind of, as I think about them, kind of the highlights from chapter 19. Then in chapter 20, we went back and we reviewed oxidation numbers. And so I'd expect that you'd be able to determine oxidation numbers. You will not be provided any table or chart on how to determine oxidation numbers. You should have that memorized. Then you should be able to determine which elements get oxidized or reduced, and then determine oxidizing agents and reducing agents. You should be able to calculate standard cell potentials. You should be able to write out cell notations and write out half reactions and overall cell reactions. You should be able to label a cell diagram in terms of electron flow, the direction of ion flow in those cells. So you recall that we had a picture in which we drew in all those things. And you should be able to tell like whether masses of anodes increase or decrease, cathodes increase or decrease, concentration increase or decrease. So we've done all those things in there. And then today, whatever we went through today, we started off with determining strength of oxidizing agents or reducing agents. And then relating delta G to E cell. And finally, some applications of electrochemistry. So, as I look at the highlights, those are the things we find. As far as what's provided for you, you're going to get a periodic table provided. Any key equations that appear at the end of the chapters will be provided. Any constants that are needed will be provided. Remember that on your periodic table, the back side has a bunch of those constants on there. Don't forget that they are there, because sometimes we'll have questions, where are the constants? And I say, well, it's in your booklet. Something like Appendix C, if needed. Now, what you may not get is delta G or delta H formations for elements in the reference form. That's because I'd expect you to know that those values are equal to zero. So, but any other ones you would be provided. Amy?
Maybe you should do the other chapter to make about the applications of electrochemistry. Should we go mainly off of
the ones that were given today, right? There's some other stuff there we just didn't get time to get to, like how a pH probe works and a few others. So anything we didn't get to today would not be on there. Okay. Anybody else? For which one? Yes. Is that there? We use the 273, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, usually we estimate the three significant figures. So 298K would be our standard temperature that we typically use. Okay, anybody else? All right. Good luck with your studying today. And try to pay attention to email today if you have questions.